Hello and welcome to The Right Question, a radio program and podcast featuring authors from the American West and beyond. Our funding comes from Humanities Montana and members of Montana Public Radio. I'm Lauren Korn. Today I'm speaking with Anthony W. Wood about his book, Black Montana, Settler Colonialism and the Erosion of the Racial Frontier, 1877 to 1930. Wood explores the racial legacy of Montana and the experience of blackness within and against the settler colonial society of the American West in the 19th and 20th centuries. Before we begin, I want to dedicate this particular episode of The Right Question to the late Alan Thompson, a cultural historian whose research and oral histories of Montana's black communities have forever changed the way so many of us now view Western history and ideas of the American West. Alan was a friend of my father's, and I have very fond memories of listening to Alan and my dad chatting on our front deck when I was a child, listening to Alan's distinct, sweet voice and his infectious and generous laughter. May he rest in power. Anthony, welcome to The Right Question.
Hello, thanks for having me.
Anthony, how did you come to write Black Montana?
So when I was in college as a senior at Carroll College in Helena, I started an internship at the Montana Historical Society in the preservation office. And Kate Hampton, who was the supervisor there at one point in my senior year, picked up the Black History Project that she had been working on, the Montana's African American Heritage Resources Project, I think is what it's actually called. She had been working on that for a very long time, almost a decade. And they had lots of censuses and stuff to work through. And they just needed someone to pull out names and addresses and find out if the houses that they had once lived in, if they were still standing, and if any of them had historical integrity, and so on. And that was my very first kind of project as a professional-ish kind of historian. So, yeah.
And by houses that they lived in, mm-hmm. you are talking about the black population in Montana.
Yes.
You were seeking mm-hmm. out these houses and communities that existed in the 19th and 20th centuries
right.
in Montana.
Yeah, specifically starting in Helena and then moving on eventually when I came back to work at the project as just a researcher, as an independent contractor doing kind of my first real job. It was every kind of major community around the state. So it was finding these cultural resources, as we say, these extant houses that are, you know, still around that we can see if they're worthy of, you know, preservation, if they still have a lot of historical integrity, if they, you know, have all the features that they did before, if there's a neighborhood. Just finding that information entailed so much research about the individuals in the house. And then once you found those houses, then you had to prove that it was a historically significant place to preserve. And then you had to do all the research. And I started helping with that as well. So that by the time I arrived at Bozeman to do my my graduate work and the master's program there, I had already kind of been working in an archive and collecting, you know, information and data for thousands and thousands of people for over like a year and a half at that point, which is usually almost as long as the master's program itself. So I had an incredible head start really on the researching process there, which allowed me to just jump really right into writing and reading newspapers and following the rabbit holes that I wanted to follow, which you don't always get the time to do in a master's program.
And then this master's thesis, for which you have all this research, it was then the jumping off point for Black Montana.
Right. And I could have taken that project into the direction of, well, this is just the history as it was. But I was so fascinated by those people's responses, by other in lectures that other people were giving, listening to the audience questions, by people in our public history meetings when we were talking about designing the website and the things that they thought people needed to know. There was this, well, no one knows this history. This is something that people would be surprised by. And if we just tell the story of there were, you know, black people here in the 19th and early 20th century, that's the story. Like somehow just the existence was going to be sufficient. And I kind of kept that with me as I started to write this. I didn't want to be telling that story and just kind of feeding into, yes, and this is a history that no one's ever heard of, and its novelty on its own should be sufficient. I was really fascinated with, like, how could you have so many people not be so surprised and And why is it that everyone just gets to be surprised about this?
And that's kind of what Black Montana is. It's mm-hmm. it's not the novelty of this invisibility, as you say. It is why there is such a small population of Black Montanans now.
Right, right.
And then the reasoning behind that, yeah.
Yeah. And that's, I mean, that's the central kind of the hypothesis, the premise of the book, is that it's, if someone just wants to learn about Black Montanans, I think there's a lot there. And that's one of the layers that I thought about as I was rewriting and editing, was it needs to have some of that history available so that people can kind of grab onto something. But then beneath and even on top of that a little bit is this idea that Montana today still is the least Black state in the United States, both by the percentage of its total population and by just the total number of Black residents living here today. And if you were to pose the question differently and go up to anyone on the street and just ask someone, why do you think this is? The responses you would get would be, I think, deeply either illogical on the surface or kind of bordering and leaning into a very common unexamined form of racialist thinking, where I have heard people with the weather kind of climactic kind of excuses and all kinds of things. We're like, well, they just never came. It was too expensive. And none of those answers, I think, should be, they're not sufficient for me as a researcher. But I'm actually kind of trying to put forward here that the general public, on top of academics, they shouldn't accept that answer either. And there's so much more we can learn about ourselves, people living in Montana today, as well as, you know, the people I'm writing about, by not allowing that question, well, why is it that this is Montana, which is, you know, in the period of time we're talking about, this was one of the places where people were moving to a lot, had a much larger population than Idaho or Wyoming or the Dakotas at certain points, especially the western half. And yet it comes to a kind of this historical reality by the mid-20th century that this is somehow not a space where Black migrants are coming to, and their communities are not kind of lasting and growing in step with everyone else, despite the fact that they had really firm and, I think, kind of fascinating historical seeds, so to speak, on all the major communities in Montana, and some small ones that were surprising, I think, that a lot of people don't hear about. And I really want, you know, this, if people can slog through it, to recognize that shouldn't be kind of just left unanswered. And that should be an examined part of how you read history, even for fun.
Well, it's interesting to me that you talk about a mainstream audience, because I did say earlier that this is an academic text, and you just used the word slog. So I think that it's important for listeners to know that although it is academic and there is a lot of academic discourse and rhetoric in the book, that you've actually supplemented it pretty well with anecdotes. There, you are introducing characters and kind of anecdotal stories to really ground your research. And I think you did that really well.
Oh, thank you.
For me or for our listeners, what does settler colonialism mean? Mm-hmm. And beyond that, I mean, the title of your book is Black Montana, Settler Colonialism and the Erosion of the Racial Frontier. So let's give our listeners a definition, maybe a layman's definition of settler colonialism and maybe what you meant or mean by racial frontier.
Right. Yeah. Settler colonialism is a concept that really emerged in the last 20 years or so, where it's a distinguished feature between franchise traditional colonialism, which we might encounter in the history of, you know, British colonization in India. Settler colonialism instead is this kind of structuring of society where, instead of a colonial government coming to a new place populated by indigenous people in that land, more or less enslaving or subjugating them as colonized people and reaping the profits while kind of using and being held up by a imported colonial government, settler colonialism rather sees power and kind of the end goal as the land itself, rather than the resources and the labor that can be extracted from it. So settlers come and they kind of form the permanent base of operations. So if you think about this in a really broad term, United States, Canada, New Zealand, Australia, those are the four like undisputed settler colonies, settler states around the world. But it is to note, it is an academic idea that has, as we think about, you know, the history of what used to be maybe migration or it was just called Settlement, to kind of really identify it as a colonial structure. In some cases, I can see how people kind of feel the edge of that, which is good. It causes you to kind of examine and investigate what is going on. How is power functioning in these societies? Who belongs and who doesn't? Which is really the question that I think without settler colonialism, you miss the home and belonging kind of themes that run through what I've tried to bring to the fore. So, and then the racial frontier is maybe a much more accessible and widely known idea in the 90s, late 80s, early 90s. Scholars started really working kind of with fervor on what became the Black West in scholarship. And one author in particular really wrote a masterful survey of the American West called In Search of the Racial Frontier by Dr. Quintard Taylor. And the racial frontier in the way that he framed it was kind of this possibility that following the Civil War, and some to a certain extent even before, it's playing with this frontier notion where African Americans, Black people living in the United States could look at the American West and imagine that this is a new racial frontier. This is the space of opportunity that felt very much parallel to the types of rhetoric and discourse that was circulating around ideas of the West at the same time for all Americans in general. And then I've always kind of also read his In Search part of that title as the historian looking for it, because it exists and it's modern and it's, you know, urban in all these kind of ways, but it's also hidden and parts of it are disappeared and it's difficult to find. So it was not a project. You know, we can look at his notes. It's not something that was easy to do. He didn't have books like a lot of surveys are written just by, you know, reading widely in the field and doing some good research. And he had to do that, but it was also kind of this intense labor. And it comes through. It's an excellent, amazing book and has so much to say about the West. So I kind of played on the racial frontier in both those settings, where one, it was, you know, why was the racial frontier so hard to find, you know, for people doing Black Western history, both, you know, decades ago and today, but also the racial frontier that Black Americans would have conceived of in some way or experienced in their own time.
Anthony, why don't you introduce us to one of these characters that you write about in Black Montana?
Sure. The woman that I begin the book with and kind of end it, and she periodically shows up, her name is Rose Gordon. She's from White Sulphur Springs, and she wrote her own memoir. So I begin the book with her because we have lots of information in her own voice. Yeah, she's born in 1883, I think, or 1881 in Barker, Montana, which is the tiny little mining camp. And she is the very first child that's born there. There were several other African Americans that had been working with the miners and as cooks and other members of this kind of operation, but she was the first child that had been born. And the midwife who delivered her was an indigenous woman, probably from the Crow tribe. And as it kind of comes through in the stories that she tells about herself, she called herself the first white child. And it's really hard to tell how she's using the designation, how she's kind of playing with race and kind of twisting it a little bit. She even notes the other members of the camp kind of snickered or kind of in kind of derisive gestures mentioned that they knew that she wasn't white, but this Crow woman would have had no way of discerning that she wasn't like everyone else, that she wasn't just another settler who was, you know, arriving on her ancestral homelands. So she kind of bestowed upon her this moniker, this kind of racial identification as being white, despite the fact that she was, both her parents were Black. And the way that shows up in her memoirs and her own personal history, I was kind of taken by, because it mirrors other Western historical accounts we have of early Black migrants to the Western United States who are kind of claiming for themselves a racial distinction that is blurring with a national distinction. And in my argument in this book is that it is also blurring with a colonial versus decolonized distinction. So there's a lot going on, and I think that it's fair to say that the way she is constantly – inserted this anecdote, which is both fun in a certain way, but in another way, I think she has a great deal of meaning behind it, as it is a claim to kind of belonging and kind of her origins in central Montana, which she writes a lot about in other parts of the book. But she kind of roots herself in this space. I'm going to read from the epilogue. In the introduction, I introduce her, and then I kind of come back to her at the end. So the land we call Montana changed drastically from the 1880s, when Rose Gordon was born as the first settler in an isolated mining camp still populated mostly by indigenous peoples, to 1971, when her personal papers arrived in Helena and were placed in the collections of the Montana Historical Society. Her parents, Annie and John, began their lives as enslaved people in Alabama and Missouri before coming to the mountains of Montana as part of the first wave of black settlers. The other settler miners and their families did not hide their bemusement when the Crow midwife who delivered Rose Gordon declared her to be the first white child, as all other children that had been born into their world had been Indians. In Gordon's retelling, their tongue-in-cheek response gave us a momentary flash of insight into the kind of world that many early white settlers imagined the American West to be. It was, in their estimation, a place where an indigenous population of racialized others would, by way of natural law, forfeit their homelands by transfer, violent or otherwise, but usually violent, to those whose hard work and tenacity had secured their own civilization that they would now plant in the very soils that would bring about a golden age of settler modernity. But if it would have been simple and unproblematic enough merely to call a new black child white and thus bestow upon her the mantle of settler and all that entailed, then the history of Rose Gordon and Black Montana would, in all probability, have played out very differently indeed. Rather than represent colorblind acceptance, the symbolism contained within the curious birth of Rose Gordon ultimately proved to be profoundly subversive to the society into which she was born. It bears mentioning that this story is, of course, from the writings of an individual produced later in her life about her own birth. Her account then would have relied upon others' remembrances, or perhaps it did not. The historicity of this event is not important. What matters here is the way the tale of Gordon's birth calls to our attention the types of stories we tell about ourselves and asks what kind of political work they might be doing. In Gordon's case, her birth was a claim of belonging, one that grew more potent as she became one of the only black people living in her community.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to a conversation with historian and scholar Anthony W. Wood, author of Black Montana. I'm Lauren Korn. This is The Right Question. Our full conversation can be found online at mtpr.org, where you can also subscribe to our podcast and follow us on Facebook. Anthony, what do black-billed magpies have to do with settler colonialism in the 20th century Montana?
Surprisingly, a lot, both as a social metaphor for how we can think about how do we engage with being outside and doing things in the natural world, what role should it have in our everyday lives. The history that I, again, just happened upon when I was reading the same sources, you know, different columns in the same paper as some other piece of history I was interested in, the way that magpies kept showing up as being explicitly and sometimes, you know, more subtly racialized as something. And the more I started looking into how they're really thinking about what the magpie was doing in the 20th century, early 20th century, the more it felt like the tension that was present in the history of the black community at the time. And so I use it as this window into the black wilderness experience, because conservationists in the 1910s, especially early 1900s, are kind of confronting a natural world which they want to conserve for the use of their society. And then you come across all their feelings about the magpies, and they think that the magpies are terrible stewards of their natural environment. They think that they are unwanted and an element in the natural world that is really out of date. Like it had a place at one point, but we don't need tons of magpies, you know, eating crops and killing and harassing sheep and eating all the game birds that we want to hunt. And their response, which was staggering to me in the 1910s and 20s, was, we'll just kill all of them. We'll kill every single magpie. We have this example here of unvarnished, violent responses to this, a paradigm that looks very similar to a whole range of colonial worldviews. And I think the way I wanted to use it, at least, was to suggest there is something real about the way we talk about these terms. They're not just totally academic jargon that have no meaning that we've reimposed on the past. We can actually look at this moment and say, like, this is a really violent response that exists in the world, and we can see it. And then I go through and show there's a lot of reason to think that these responses were also themselves kind of the product of a very racialized world. Birds especially, magpies, jays, and crows, all very racialized within American popular culture as African Americans. Jim Crow also kind of being a minstrel character itself, and then moving on to kind of the name we have given the system of segregation and oppression across the United States. So there was a lot there, and I felt like the magpie was this interesting moment where I could talk about how people thought about nature and the outdoors, but also how racism kind of permeates and saturates all parts of people's worldviews, and that something even as great and as wonderful as the desire to preserve nature and to, you know, set it aside apart from, you know, total consumption and for something in the future is itself going to have a racial history. And the evidence of that racial history, while I use the magpie as the metaphor to get into it, it's that when you go into the kind of the archive of Black Montanans, they're also out there in the natural world, kind of fostering this ethic of use and stewardship and conservation in the same ways and at the same moments. But until these projects really come to fruition and we find and archive and collect and talk about the kind of the Black experiences within nature and the outdoors and the wilderness, it's really easy to say, like, well, I guess Black people must have lived only in the towns. They must not have gone out and participated in the same way with this really important cultural motif in for Montana, especially kind of this stewardship of the great outdoors being so central to a lot of people's state and regional identity. This is one of those histories that when it's stripped away and you don't get to see it, an understandable but wrong perception is that Black Montanans somehow were separate from it and that they weren't part of this history and they didn't add anything to it or, you know, change it or pull on the way that people kind of experienced the outdoors, which that chapter argues is not the case and that we simply have ignored it. It's hard to find, but we can see kind of the imprint of it. We can follow and trace that ethic and desire to go out and be outside and all that is there. We just haven't really looked for it yet.
I ask many of the authors who appear on the show about what they know or believe to be, quote unquote, the so-called American West. My question to you, though, in light of this book, is how does the American West that you know now, after publishing this book, after doing all the research for this book, how does that American West differ from the American West that you grew up in, that you were familiar with mm-hmm. prior to all this research?
I have always been a person growing up in the West that I felt there was a Westernness, something out there, and I was never able to really pinpoint what that was. I did start thinking about it as I was researching. So the way I thought about the West was very much informed by the conversation, which is not typically how I think that process goes. Growing up in Montana, I thought the West was first and foremost empty, which is one of the problematized elements of my own rendering. If I had a pinpoint coming to terms with the West was, it would have been, you know, me hiking in the mountains around nobody. And, you know, that's a terribly imprecise and not very useful idea of what it means to be in the West. So I'm fortunate enough that as I kind of got to a point in my life where I'm starting to think about my place, what it meant to be at home here, I was also getting to read all the accounts that a lot of people either don't have the chance to or they're not interested in. And that has definitely shaped how I think about the West now, so much so that it's hard for me to even cast my mind back. So part of it is, you know, the abundance of indigenous histories, which I have got to read since starting grad school. That has changed the way I think about the mid-19th century in this place where I feel at home. The recognition that it's someone else's home that they had to leave and that it's still their home. There's a kind of a catchphrase that is used from time to time where it's like home, not home, where I recognize that I am at home in someone else's home. That has been, I think, important for me as I've begun to encounter more and more stories, individuals, people who are living at a different time, that my own positionality of thinking about what does it mean to belong in a place, how would they have rendered home, is recognizing that my version of home and the way I think about it is anything but stable. And I think that has freed me to kind of try to practice some type of historical empathy as a researcher, to think like, well, this person might have thought about home so strongly and differently than me that I really need to sit with them kind of as a historical figure in the archive, or think about what I don't know about them or what I can never know about them. I do mention, like, there's a lot of Rose Gordon's story, which I don't know what it meant to her. Those, the stories she told about herself were really for her in many ways. And we can look at those, but there's a level of interiority to these questions, which I kind of just have to recognize and flag for people so they can come to their own thoughts about them, but then kind of move on, because we can't dig into a person's, you know, deepest thoughts. We can only listen to what they give us. And sometimes in this book especially, so few people are giving us their thoughts. And then the voices we do have are so often in conversation, which then requires you to understand both the other person or group of people they're talking to, or the political moment or the discourse, or a word that I use a lot, kind of the ideology behind what they're saying, that it becomes a very complicated task. So I felt like this became a more useful and interesting story when everything was just put out and, you know, layered on top of one another thematically, and readers could move through it and say, or come to a greater understanding at least of what it meant to be a home in this place. And I think that the Black community in Montana is one of the most clear and useful histories to do that work, because they are straddling this line that Rose Gordon identified in her memoir, this being, you know, a colonizer, but also colonized, being home, being not home. There's a very universal sense to which I'm thinking about these terms. But at the same time, if I were to go back and look at white Montanans living in the same era, the answers I would be looking for would be so obscured by the politics of the day, by racial ideology, their own presuppositions about things, their own biases. It would be almost impossible to find it. And yet in this community, which no one knows about, as they tell everyone in our public, history, you know, lectures and meetings and stuff, the answers are much more clear if we spend some time and think about it carefully. I kind of do like the idea of people reading it slowly. You could take 6 months to read this book if you followed every inclination, that's the ideal.
Anthony, thank you so much for being here.
Thanks for having me. It was wonderful.
Look for more information about Anthony at mtpr.org, where you can also subscribe to our podcast and follow us on Facebook. You've been listening to The Right Question. The show is produced by Peter Hoag and me. I'm your host, Lauren Korn. Our recording engineer is Beth Ann Ostein. Many thanks to Humanities Montana for supporting this program since 2008, and thank you for listening. The Right Question is a production of Montana Public Radio.